Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen, made in collaboration with my good friends at the amazing charity Help Musicians. And in this episode, my musical guest is a singer-songwriter, musician, born in Edinburgh. She released her debut album in 2004. It was called Eye to the Telescope. But she really came to the nation's attention with a show-stopping performance on Jules Holland's Later. That album would quickly rack up a whole armful of awards, lucky lady. Since that incredible start, she's released 6 albums, recorded in Berlin, moved to Los Angeles, and has toured all over the globe. Please welcome the most wonderful Katie Tunstall. Welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast for Help Musicians. It's lovely to have you. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm very well. It's been a revelatory and very odd, reflective, deep time, all of this time at home for us musicians, I think. I haven't spoken to anyone who's gone, yeah, life is kind of just the same. Getting back to normal.
So have you been in your emotional loft?
I've been in my emotional loft. I've found a basement that I didn't know existed. I found the keys for many empty rooms, Chris.
But have you been productive?
It's been very productive. It's been quite selective in how I've been able to tap into that productivity, because I'm making the final record in a trilogy of records based on soul, body and mind in that order. And the soul album was, you know, my dad had passed and my marriage had broken up and I'd sold everything I owned and moved to America and I didn't think I was going to make a record, and I made this album. And then I thought, wow, this really feels like this kind of regeneration of self. And then the next record was about the body, and halfway through that record, I lost my hearing on one side, which was a huge shock. So I'm just thinking, what the fuck is going to happen on the mind record, you know? You know, who knows? And this happens. The whole world loses its blob, you know? Yeah. And we all experience this weird collective madness over the last 18 months. But I did find it really difficult to write lyrics for myself. I just didn't feel like I really had anything to say. I sort of have to go into more of a dream state, an imagination state, to write lyrics, and I couldn't really get there. I couldn't get out of reality. It was clawing at me all the time. And so I instead got involved in writing a stage musical, which I've never done before. And it was massively challenging and it was a huge amount of work, but I managed it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, very proud. I spent most of the time feeling like I was procrastinating and being horribly lazy, but actually also managing to get it done. So the lesson is, don't bother feeling lazy and like you're procrastinating. You're getting it done. So just be over the moon that you're spending the day doing nothing and then working from 8 o'clock at night.
So did you have to re-educate your musical self to write a musical?
It was really just a huge learning curve from scratch. I'll tell you what the most challenging thing was that I came up against was, obviously I can write a tune, I can do a melody. I love writing comedy. It's a comedy and it was really good fun. Yeah, I don't use humour in that way really in my own music. So that was brilliant. But the really challenging thing was, so an adaptation of a movie called Saving Grace with wonderful Brenda Blethyn and Craig Ferguson wrote it. And it's really funny about this middle-aged woman who starts growing weed to make money. But there's a scene where the lead character, Grace, is kind of faced with the woman that her late husband was having an affair with, and they need to have this argument. And I'm realizing, oh my God, I have to write them arguing in real time while they're singing. This is why I hate musicals. Because it's just not real. Why on earth would you be singing? And how do you neatly rhyme? How do you tie up an argument so that it's structural? You know, you're talking over each other and you're screaming at each other and you don't know what you're going to say. And I just suddenly had a freak out and was just like, I don't know if I can do that. Because songwriting, obviously, you're always kind of writing with hindsight, and it's a memory in your storytelling. Or you're projecting, you know, you're rarely saying, I feel this right now. Oh my God, as I'm writing this song, I suddenly feel nervous.
Well, Sondheim is an expert at that. Did you study anybody else? Did you listen to other people?
So before the lockdown, I was actually working on another musical, and that kind of thankfully stalled during this time because there's no way I could have done two at the same time. And I actually did a lot of field trips in London going to see various different musicals. And I think one of the things that did affect me most was actually going back and watching the original West Side Story film.
Yeah, really.
You know, it's more like classical music. It's really just exceptionally bold as well. And, you know, I think that there's a misconception that musicals sort of need to appeal to the lowest common denominator and sort of simplify everything, because that certainly doesn't. Yeah. It's challenging and wonderful. So, and sometimes it's the same as when you're listening to music. Sometimes you get completely freaked out when you hear someone brilliant and you think, well, what's the fucking point of me doing it at all? They're way too good at it. I'll never be that good.
When you first listened to music, when you were, I guess, a teenager, how did it make you feel? Were you drawn to any style?
Well, I remember my favourite song when I was four. My dad was a physicist, and neither my mum or dad had a record collection. They didn't listen to much music. And dad had about six C90 cassette tapes. And he had Bach, Mozart, Billie Holiday, who I couldn't stand when I was young and love now, the Chariots of Fire soundtrack.
No.
And Tom Lehrer, if you're familiar with him. So, you know, my dad being a physicist and Tom Lehrer being this kind of Harvard mathematician satirist. And my favourite song was The Table of Elements. And it's Tom Lehrer going, hydrogen, lithium and oxygen, oh, helium. You know, and just perfectly, perfectly rhyming every single element on The Table of Elements. And it's genius. Yeah. And very much in that world of classic musical theatre songwriting.
You weren't a Top of the Pops girl then?
I was that too, for sure. Oh, I loved Top of the Pops, and I remember, I mean, the music in the 80s was just, it's maybe my favourite era of songwriting, you know, which seems sacrilegious to say because the 60s and 70s. But when it comes to actual joyful songs that really make me just lose myself, it's these amazing, unhinged, totally non-self-conscious pop songs that are wonderful.
Were you watching Top of the Pops thinking, I'd like to do that?
Well, you know, I didn't. You know, growing up in the 80s, it's Whitney Houston, it's Prince and Wham, Duran Duran, and it was all very glamorous and polished and pretty two-dimensional, but great songwriting and really fun. I was just telling a friend how annoyed I was when I found out George Michael was gay. I felt so hoodwinked. I was like, but you went on a skiing holiday with ladies. But it was actually when my dad got a satellite dish because he wanted to watch the rugby that I found MTV and I started watching and they were playing a much wider scope of stuff. I think Kim Wilde probably piqued my interest on Top of the Pops. I thought she was really cool. But none of the other artists I saw made me think, I want to do that. But it was when I saw, actually, the Stone Roses and Beck. Mm-hmm. Beck's video for Loser and the song Loser came out. Yeah. And at the same time, I had sort of joined a local band, which was King Creosote's band, which was a sort of, it was like kind of punk, Kaylee, rockabilly, you know, bluegrass.
Oh, genius band.
Absolutely
genius
amazing.
Band.
But also from my town, who we were kind of friends with, was the Beta Band. And the Beta Band had gone down to London and done, you know, they were like the Gaudi of St. Andrews in Fife, where they just did, they did it. They went down south and they got a record deal. Mm. And they were really making very kind of boundary pushing music. They had a DJ in the band. They were using acoustic guitars, but chopping them up all over the place and using samples and... I mean, that three EPs collection of the Beta Bands just still sounds like it could come out now. It's really amazing music, I think. And so it was actually more, I think, the lifestyle that I found with these musicians in Fife, where I suddenly realised I was maybe didn't need to get a job and I could just live off-grid, frugally, hand-to-mouth, and that completely appealed to me. There was no kind of like, I want to be on Top of the Pops and have a video and wear nice shoes. It was all about really living a subversive lifestyle outside of having to get a job and clocking in.
So there was no musical comfort at home, so to speak? No record collection?
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. But I think the really deep support that I found at home was possibly because I'm adopted. Me and my older brother are adopted, and my mum and dad were very dedicated to allowing us to find out what we were good at. And that didn't necessarily look like them. So whatever we sort of fancied having a go at, they would say, you know, well, as long as you don't waste money and time and put some effort in, then we'll get you lessons. I asked for a piano when I was 4 years old and got one and got lessons and started flute when I was a bit older and got all my grades. And I was dancing, I was tap dancing and doing a bunch of sports stuff. So that's not always the case in a family situation. You know, sometimes they can't afford it. Sometimes it's not encouraged. But it was quite funny, that resilience to say, well, if you try really hard and if you work really hard, you'll get good at it. And then I sort of turned around to my parents at the end of university and said, guess what? I'm going to be a performer. And they went, no! How is this possible? I'm like, well, you said if you try really hard, you can do something. So, yeah, that bit them on the arse.
So it sounds like you definitely did have a lot of love there.
There was lots of love. And I think, you know, as I get older, I can look at my parents' story and, you know, it's so easy for us to just sit back and blame our parents for everything.
Everything, yeah.
And I think as I get older, and my dad's passed now, but I find myself closer to my mum now than I've been before. And being able to look at her situation, it's very difficult adopting kids. It's a huge undertaking, and particularly for their generation, you know, they weren't a very physically affectionate generation. They weren't an I love you generation. And so really I see that all of that love was coming through this actually very generous support of allowing me to be who I was rather than trying to turn me into something that they wanted me to be, you know.
That's a lovely thing.
Yeah, and in the end, yeah, they were both incredibly proud and, I guess, impressed by my resilience to just carry on, because it took me a decade to get anywhere. I sort of started on the journey of really wanting to be a professional musician at around 18 or 19, and I didn't get onto the Jules Holland show until when everything kicked off until I was 29. I got my record deal at 29, and most people, I think, would have given up by then.
You have an eternal youth about you.
As do you.
Which is a really... which is a lovely thing, you know. Yeah. Whenever I hear you singing or performing, it's like you're 12 years old. Yeah. It's like you're really enjoying it. You're right in the middle of you.
I do feel that. And I feel quite passionately as well that silliness and play are really crushed out of people a lot of the time. Mm. And that there's this massive mistake that we make, that growing up requires removing that part of ourselves. And I think that that was something I felt very rebellious about, that I am not losing this part of myself. This is the funnest area of life, is to be stupid and to be, you know, to just play. And it's partly why I really like Japan, that when I go to Japan, there's no inhibition or embarrassment for adults to like toys and like cartoons and like what we would call babyish things. Mm. And that culture has a kind of youth to it.
It does.
Which I feel our lovely little island, Britain, can kind of become very earnest
and stiff, serious.
Yeah. And play is where, you know, creativity comes from. It's when you're in the business of creating something from nothing, from a completely blank space, and suddenly you give birth to something, you got to have a shag to make the baby. You got to be able to kind of lose yourself a little, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When did you first sort of fall into being the songwriter that you are? When did you first sort of play a song to yourself and go, you know what, this is what I want to do?
Well, I always loved creative writing. So it started with rhyming kind of poems, but lyrics. I loved Roald Dahl. I would read Roald Dahl all the time. I loved Dr. Seuss. I would read that all the time. And part of the reason I loved those two writers was because they adopted perfect rhyme. They would never, ever try and slip in an extra syllable. They would find the perfect rhythmic rhyme. Mm-hmm. And I think ever since, you know, appreciating those two writers, I just am completely intolerant of a bad rhythm in a lyric. It's like, you can't fit that word. You cheated. You lose.
I understand that. Yeah.
So I have a really deep appreciation for that craftsmanship of rhythm and rhyme. I really loved emulating that kind of those perfect rhymes. And then I think my first song was on piano when I was about 15. I was quite late to start writing songs. Mm-hmm. And I was just tinkling away on my own. And I was probably took me a few, you know, goes mm-hmm. around to get to an actual song. And it was called Only You. And it was a song about being cheated on. And I'd never been cheated on. So I don't know what the hell I was talking about. I think it was like the storyline in Dynasty. There was these two characters called Miles and Claudia. And Miles had cheated on Claudia. And I was just so angry about it. And so I wrote this song, Only You, and it's not bad. Mm. I still remember it. It was very cheesy, though. I found that writing on piano, it was very predictable and obvious and not very exciting. And so it was when I picked up guitar and taught myself. So I never had guitar lessons and just worked my way around it myself. And I can't really play bar chords, so I was playing a lot of open tuning chords, and that became actually really part of my style. I found that that was absolutely much more the instrument for me, where I could write more original music. Mm-hmm. I can't improvise very well on piano. I never mastered it.
That's probably because it's got too many notes.
It's just way too many notes. It's too big. It's just too big. I'm too small. That's the problem.
Yeah. So when did you get your first guitar?
So my first guitar, I was probably about 15 and I was at school in Dundee, and there was a really nice music department and I was doing well at music already, and there was a guitar teacher called Tim, and for some reason I never got guitar lessons, which is weird now I think about it. I don't know why I didn't, but he always let me borrow a guitar, and I'd just go and nick a guitar on my free periods where you're meant to be studying and go in a room on my own, and I had a little busking book. And I just worked out the chords from the tablature. It's funny, he never said, shall I give you a lesson? Right. He just let me borrow this guitar, and it was a Spanish nylon string. So it was quite a different experience playing a Spanish nylon string. It's very wide neck. They're really kind of built to be picked and, you know, played flamenco style. So I started out as a picker. I was just learning picking techniques, and that sort of naturally meant that I was writing quite gentle folk-oriented material. And then I met King Creaso after doing a little gig of some of my songs in a pub at 6 o'clock in the back room, because I wasn't meant to be in there because I was underage, but they let me do a little gig for my friends. And he asked me to join the band, which was called the Scooby-Doo Orchestra, Gaelic spelling, D-U-B-H. And they were all busking. They were all making money playing on the street. They would kind of go around Europe for the summer and just crash on people's couches and live on what they were making. So I started busking and playing on the street and very, very quickly realised that you cannot do that with a Spanish nylon string guitar. It's a complete waste of time. No one can hear you. So I had to quickly learn how to use a pick, how to strum. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that happened, I was like, I have a percussion section here. It's not just a guitar. This is like having a drum kit.
This is pre-loop.
It's pre-loop. Yes, exactly. Loop only happened after I'd made my first record. Mm-hmm. So I had gone into the studio. It was really me, a drummer and a bass player, and then a few little bits of piano and whatever else. But it was primarily rhythm guitar and drums. And that was kind of the breakthrough with Steve Osborne, brilliant producer, that whenever I played with a band, when I was trying to get somewhere, it just sounded really boring. It was more exciting if I was just on my own. And then it would just get ironed out and flattened with the band, because the drummer is kind of just, you know, doing the regular. And Steve realized that actually my rhythm section is my rhythm guitar and the drums, and the bass can actually be more of a melodic instrument in my setup. So I've always thought of my rhythm section as actually acoustic guitar and drums, not bass and drums.
Yeah. Who did you get your publishing deal with, your first one?
Well, it was really funny because I was going down to London, spending all my dole check on getting on a bus.
Yeah.
I was offered my friend's couch, but I felt so bad sleeping on his couch because his housemate had a proper job and had to get up at 7 a.m. and make her breakfast, that I ended up sleeping behind the couch. I would pull the couch out 3 feet and just pretend I wasn't there and sleep behind the couch on the floor. And I would go down to London and do these gigs, and I was playing in a little club called Cashmere Club, which was just, brilliant. Yeah. It was just a really shitty little basement that leaked, which was just the vibiest place you could ever imagine.
Was that Tony Moore?
It was Tony Moore, and I'm still in touch with Tony. Okay. I was trying to do all these meetings with people and trying to network, which I'm not very good at. And this, I can't remember his last name, which is probably a good thing, but he was called Martin, and he was running some publishing company, and I got offered 12 grand for everything I'd ever written and everything I was ever going to write.
Oh, no.
And it seemed like, you know, when you've got no money, I was like, wow, 12 grand. And a guy who'd been an A&R guy who was kind of pivoting into management, Simon Banks, who was my first manager, he was constantly on me going, get rid of your crap band, come to London on your own, let me get you a deal. And I finally called him and said, I got this offer for a publishing deal, but I think it's crap. Can you help me out? And he did help me out. And he said, I'll work for you for 6 months for free with no contract. And if you get a deal, just make sure I get my 20% of the deal. And then you can decide whether we go on. And he had Warner, Chrysalis and Sony all bidding within. You know, that first offer was I really appreciate it because it was some leverage to then go into the fray. And so I signed a pretty good deal with Sony in the end.
Yeah, that's really lucky.
I'm still with them, actually. I'm still with the same label and the same publisher 15 years
something
later.
Something to be said for that. Something to be said for
I
that.
I think that's so. Sure. I mean, either I'm an idiot or...
No, you're not. That's lovely.
I feel quite proud of that in this environment where, you know, it's just so volatile to sort of still have the confidence of these big old companies is something, isn't it?
As well as these chats with my musical friends, we've also been meeting musicians who've benefited from Help Musicians and whose careers have been saved and supported by this wonderful charity. Whether through financial support, mental health support, training, mentoring or enhancing skill sets. Please meet Ed Blunt, a singer-songwriter who I met on my Help Musicians workshops.
I only came to songwriting fairly recently. I always wanted to write songs, but I was always more of a sort of instrumentalist. So my first musical endeavours were playing the drums, because I was obsessed with the drums. Every Friday evening, Top of the Pops, I would just be looking at the drummer, and I wanted to do that. And then I got obsessed with the piano. I just really wanted to be able to play chords to the songs that I'd been playing on the drums. And my dad had sort of a very basic knowledge of how to bash out a C major chord and a G major chord. So he taught me the beginning bits. And then I had traditional piano lessons in which a teacher tried to get me to read music, and I didn't do very well with that. The Paul Simons and the James Taylors, that was the music that my dad listened to in the car. And I think when you start writing songs, it's childhood stuff that is always there at the back. So Paul Simon's lyricism and James Taylor's approach to harmony and feel, those are probably the two main influences. The Help Musicians have been amazing over the last year and a bit. As soon as everything shut down the music industry, like all musicians, I basically lost all my work overnight. Help Musicians, they were amazing, putting out all these bursary applications to help people through. And your songwriting retreats, that really opened up a lot of creative space for me, I think, during the pandemic when we didn't have much on. I think I have songs inside of me, but it takes a lot of energy and hard work to get them out. And basically, I've realised that it's just a matter of doing it every day and sitting down in a very organised fashion and going until something hooks you in. And then when I'm hooked into a song, I can go for hours. It's finding the spark, isn't it? Basically, I can't write a song when I sit at the piano. I can only write songs when I'm in the wrong place. I often find the song comes to me just when I'm nodding off to sleep. I don't really have ambitions to be a pop star. I don't really have ambitions to perform that much, really. I don't particularly enjoy performing. I really want to be writing for other people. Particularly, I'd love to write for film. I really like writing songs that cross age categories. Love writing songs for kids that adults can hold on to as well. So I'd love to do a Pixar film one day.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. What was it like coming to London for the first time? Did you embrace it or were you nervous about being around?
I'm not a city person at all. I love immersing myself in city life, but it doesn't really suit me to live in it. So I want to sort of retreat and just have my little... I'm a wildling. I'm north of the wall. I think the thing that I didn't like most about it was that I'd grown up in St. Andrews, and St. Andrews is just this amazing, rugged, carved by the sea and the wind, beautiful place. And I grew up with a sky full of stars, on my bike at 8 a.m. and not coming home till 6, 5 beaches, just, you know, nature. And then I think what really disturbed me about the city was that all you could see were other people. Instead of comparing myself to these great landscapes and always enjoying feeling small in that picture, you're suddenly down there comparing yourself to other people. And of course, entering into the music business, you're sort of also encouraged to be competitive against other bands and against other acts. And are you doing as well as this band? And this girl's doing this album and it's, you know, it's on the A list and you're on the C list. And I found that really toxic. I have absolutely no negative feelings about ambition with your craft, but putting yourself up against other musicians is really not good, because then you end up making the same shit.
I mean, the great thing, Kate, is you're so individual. You're not like anybody else. So you do stand out like a beacon, which is lovely.
Thank you.
So you don't have to look at the A or the B, C list.
I don't anymore. Yeah, I don't anymore. I did. I drank the Kool-Aid for a while of feeling like you can win. There's no winning. Because as soon as you win the award, it lasts a couple of weeks and then you're like, right, I need to win another award for the next song and the next album, you know?
You've won some fantastic awards. Which ones do you hold close to your heart?
I think the one I feel particularly proud of is my Ivor Novello Award. I mean, I think that award ceremony is very singular anyway, you know? And I think it's the best because it's not televised, actually. I think because it's closed doors and it's industry and artists and... I just feel that these televised awards are just built for popularity. And so it's just the stuff that people want to watch is going to win.
They just seem to be built for commercial breaks.
Yes, exactly. So the Ivors is still, you know, and also it's more fun because of that. So everyone's just completely letting their hair down and going nuts because no one's watching. But there's a real gravitas to that award. And I felt very proud because I won for Suddenly I See for Best Song of the Year. And I was just really proud that I went up there on my own, you know. Oh, there was a lot of other songs winning and it was kind of 7 people going up.
Yeah,
and
I saw that.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. And it's not to judge because songs are songs. Great songs are great songs. Sometimes it's one person, sometimes it's a duo, sometimes it's 10 people. But from an ego massage point of view and from a pride point of view, it was really cool. Just stepping up there on my own and going, I wrote this in my shitty basement flat in Gospel Oak in half an hour. And here I am.
I know. So they're always the best ones, aren't they? The ones that take half an hour.
Always. And I think that was something I learned during the lockdown where I was writing this musical where I would be really beating myself up that I wasn't spending all day at the computer or with a pen and a pad writing. And I was thinking, oh God, you know, I should be working, I should be working, I should be working. And after a few months of kind of flagellating myself, I was like, I'm getting the work done. I might feel bad that I'm not working all day, but I'm clearly not going to work during the day. I'm going to go downstairs at 8 o'clock after dinner and do 2 or 3 hours, and I'm getting it done. And so I really had to sit myself down and say, the space is a really integral part of the process. Because I know I'm chewing, and I know that the wheels are turning. And I actually think it's really arrogant to think that you can sit down and write on command. I'm not in control of that. I don't know how it works. I always find it funny when you're asked to do these masterclasses for songwriting, because I just sit down and go, I've no idea. I don't know how I do it. Just sit down. It happens.
It does happen. And sometimes people look at you and they say, what are you doing? You say, I'm writing a song. And they say, no, you're not. You're looking out the window.
Yeah, exactly. But that's great.
I'm writing a song.
I'm stealing that, Chris. Whenever I'm doing nothing, I'm going to go, I'm writing a song. One thing I have found as well is that when you have those ideas in the middle of the night, I have to get up now.
I never do that.
Do you not? Because I didn't used to, and I think, oh, I'll remember it. And so many times I'd wake up and I hadn't remembered it, and it was getting too annoying. So now I've got the phone and I'll just do the voice note in the middle of the night or on a plane. Or I was in a cab the other day and I was like, sorry, I have to sing in the back of your cab. I was like, la, la, la. I've got so many of those.
Is stage now home, being on stage?
It was becoming so. And I realised I didn't want that, actually. When I started touring, I thought, this is it. I want to be on a bus for the rest of my life, touring. And actually, I've ended up not feeling like that. I've ended up feeling like there's lots of other things I would like to do. And the reason I got into this was to avoid a repetitive life. And anything that you do over and over and over again can become completely repetitive.
It's the loop.
Yes, the loop, the dreaded loop. And also, because I lost my hearing, that was a huge shock. It was in the middle of a tour.
Right.
And you know what the really annoying thing was? That I have tinnitus, and I still have tinnitus, even though it's deaf.
Do you know the producer, Chris Thomas?
I've heard of him, yeah. I don't know him.
He did all of the Pretenders albums.
Yeah,
he did some Who albums,
mm-hmm.
Elton John albums. He's always been deaf in one ear. Mm. When I was in a studio with him once, he was just turned his head towards the speakers, and it's about feeling the sound.
Well, Al Schmidt was the same.
Yeah.
The producer mixer. He's got like 45 Grammys or something, you know, and did Sly and the Family Stone, and he would just sit at the desk, side saddle. You know, listening.
I mean, I've seen you on stage, obviously, you know, with Squeeze last year at Madison Square Garden. You had a bit of a sticky night there.
That was crazy. So it was all this build-up, you know. It's one of those venues that you just is on your bucket list of dreams. And I was about 2 minutes into the first song, and it turned out that the loom of cabling to the stage had not been properly connected.
Oh, no.
And all my power went down apart from my microphone. So I was literally on stage at Madison Square Gardens with 20,000 people and a mic, you know, thinking, shit, I've got 20 minutes. I've only got 5 songs to play, and this is taking one of them out. And, you know, my insides are just being shredded with disappointment that it hasn't gone perfectly. And I was kind of getting to the point where I was like thinking, because it was taking a while to get it sorted. I thought maybe I should start singing a cappella, you know, just start singing something. It could be very special. And I actually didn't end up needing to do that. They sorted it out. But I did manage to say, I'll tell you what, Madison Square Gardens, if my 15-year-old self could see all my shit going wrong in this venue, she'd be really pleased.
I know.
And actually, in the end, you know, people were really rooting for me because they could see how hard it was. And that was years of experience giving me the extra ball to deal with that, for sure.
There was 22,000 people in the palm of your hand giving you all the love.
It was really special. And I bawled my eyes out after I came off stage. It was just so much adrenaline.
Yeah.
You know, in the end, I was really proud, and it was not a negative experience. It was pretty special.
Not at all.
The other thing I remember thinking is, like, very few people have stood on that stage and played completely alone.
That's true.
So
I would imagine.
Yeah, just to have the opportunity to do that was pretty amazing. But yeah, I think my deafness was caused by very intense, prolonged touring. And I am now at a stage where I'm like, I have to look after this other one, because otherwise I can't live my life the way I want to if anything happens to this other ear, and I've got to be really careful.
So are you picking and choosing?
I'm just having to really sort of be careful and be wise. I'm not a very wise person. I've not made the wisest of choices throughout my life. I'm very impulsive and I get very, very excited, and that will often override sensible choices, for sure.
How is Los Angeles for you?
Well, I love it. There's that amazing saying, which was Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, and he said, if you turn America on its side, anything loose lands in California.
That's great.
Isn't that great?
That is great.
I like to think of LA as a kind of anthropomorphic version of Twitter, where it completely depends on who you follow. Of what experience you have. And if you only follow wildlife accounts and comedians, it's quite fun. It's very easy to live in denial here. And I live up a mountain in Topanga, so I can pretend I'm not in a city here. No problem. There's coyotes outside the window and owls in the garden. And there's just a multitude of different experiences of life here in a way that I haven't sort of... Obviously, that's the same in any city, but it's really extreme in LA. I think it just always feels a bit apocalyptic. It just feels like there's several ways that this could just go down in flames, literally. There could be a tsunami. There could be an earthquake. There could be a fire. Mm-hmm. I have to sort of, when I leave my house, I'm like, I have to be at peace with the fact that my house might burn down today.
No.
And it's just, you know.
Just the way it
is. It's just the way it is. My dog might die because it was bitten by a rattlesnake. It's just
it
the way it
like
is.
It seems like quite a sober city compared to New York or Boston, for instance.
That's also why I liked it, actually, was because I'd had a very, very hard partying 10 years and I'd had a bunch of kidney issues with my health, and I just really needed to get healthy. And it's very easy to live healthily here.
What would you say it was... Maybe one of the lowest points of your career thus far that you went, I'm not sure if I can get out of this one.
What had happened was, it was 2012 and I'd started making a record with Hau Gelb from Giant Sand in Tucson. And we'd done the first half of it and I didn't know it was a record. And it turns out my A&R guy was a huge Hau Gelb fan and was just like, this is amazing. And it was a really melancholic, down-tempo kind of Americana record, because I was making it in Arizona with Hau, and it got too hot in Arizona over the summer, so I took the summer off. And in that summer my dad died, and I realized I had just totally married the wrong person, and I was just living a life that didn't feel like mine. And you know, it's a huge thing when you lose a parent. And someone had said a brilliant quote to me, which was that your parents give birth to you twice, once when you're born and once when they die, which really resonated very deeply with me, because my dad passing was actually quite a gift. I really considered it a very life-changingly positive thing as well as a negative thing, where it really made me look at my life. And it was so annoying because I'd made all the decisions. I was my own boss. I had followed my heart and I fucked it up. I got to a place where I was really miserable. And I was like, oh, I'm not even working for anyone. You know, I've done it myself. And I remember during that time, I realized that my identity had been completely ingested by my job. Just didn't know who I was. And it was a really horrible feeling. It was like having amnesia, you know. It was just suddenly a waking up to the fact that if someone chopped my hands off and I couldn't sing anymore, I would be a shell. I just had no idea who I'd become. I'd become this caricature of what I thought people liked and what I thought was successful and what I thought would do well in the world. And I just knew that was really bad. And that was not the recipe for a good life. And that was my switch up. And also, I'm sure you can relate to this, that I was I had started kind of not really realizing I was fashioning relationships that didn't need me. So yeah. I didn't want to miss people, and I didn't want to have a home. I didn't want to have roots down, because that would be painful when I was touring and that was all I did. And, you know, at the same time becoming kind of more distant from my family. And then I was just like, Jesus Christ, this thing, this job is just coming first before anyone and anything. I was missing weddings, yeah. missing funerals, missing kids growing up. You know, you're like an oil rig worker who never goes home.
I always think whenever we go on tour, we're like submariners.
Yeah.
Going in a submarine.
Yeah, yeah.
All that turbulence down below. During the pandemic, I've spoken to a lot of musicians who have never spent this amount of time at home with their wives or kids and stuff. And they're finding it really tricky because they don't know how to be fathers or pals, you know. You know, that going in the loft, the emotional loft during the lockdown has been very useful for a lot of us, I think.
Yeah. I think probably one of the things that's been good for... This is a massive sweeping generalization, and you can come at me if you wish, but I think it's probably been quite good for dads to go home and hang out with the kids, you know, and see what that looks like and reconnect with an actual family unit and that kind of much more mud hut, all of you together in one space, you know. And for me, I've been in LA quite a lot on my own. And I think what's been really great for me is realizing how much I love my own company. I don't need to be distracted all the time. The other thing I realized is I don't get bored.
No.
I could look out a window for 4 hours. I'm just like...
I know
that feeling. I'm never bored. I could do this all day.
Well, I know that feeling so well. And that's very frustrating when you're living with other people, because I'm never bored. I just look out the window lots of hours of the day.
Yeah.
But I've always been like that. And I think songwriters have the ability to create their own space. Mm-hmm. Like the Pure Eternus, you know, we live in the clouds.
Yeah.
But we try and connect our feet to the ground, and it's quite difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, you need a long body.
You need a long body. Were you with your father when he passed?
No, I was on tour, of course.
There you go. Yeah.
And he'd had Parkinson's, and he'd had an accident where he'd broken his neck, and that just was the end of it. You know, Parkinson's makes it difficult to swallow, and I mean, it's just a complete nightmare scenario of symptoms. It was so... interesting. My dad was a physicist, and so he'd always very much kind of lived with this philosophy that you are from cosmic dust and you return to cosmic dust, which is actually a really beautiful spirituality. Nothing is new. Everything is recycled in the universe, you know. And I was sort of surprised how reluctant he was. He was so resilient, really, carrying on as long as he did. And I think it was a lovely thing in the end. It felt like he was doing it to stay with us. And that was really nice. But once he'd gone, I'd never seen a dead body before. And I visited him after he passed away. And I was like, this is literally just a bag of bones. He's not there anymore. He's gone. And that speaks to me of this amazing kind of unknown energy of what we are, you know. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the body.
He
left the building. And that was very profound.
Yeah, I remember that when my father died, the nurse called all the brothers into the room where he was lying, and he just looked round and he went with a huff of air.
And you were there?
And I was there.
Wow.
And my brothers were inconsolable, and I just thought it was the most beautiful thing.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, he's had an incredible life.
Yeah.
Fought in the Second World War and all that stuff. And then he just wanted his sons in the room, and he went.
Yeah, that's a good life. That's
a
life,
good life
well lived. My kind of mantra for life now is die well.
Title of my next album, Die
that's,
Well, ladies and gentlemen.
You know, and that's a long game to die well.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. So with that on one side, on the other side, what would you say was, like, you know, this moment, this peak experience of being a songwriter, being Katie Tunstall? What was that peak experience like?
I mean, it's funny because it would be easy to say when I won my Brit Award and, you know, you're on TV and your mum and dad are there and Prince is presenting and I'm in a category with Kate Bush and I win, you know. It is very nice being recognised widely for achievements and talent and all of those things. But actually, my favourite moments are these very special acknowledgements from musicians I admire, like yourself. But I remember I'd met Stevie Nicks through my very good friend, Vanessa Carlton. We'd gone out for dinner for Vanessa's birthday. And she said, do you want to come out for dinner? It'll just be us and Stevie. And I was like, sure, I'll be there in 7 seconds. And, you know, it was a wonderful night. And then a few months later, Fleetwood Mac had reformed. They were playing in Wembley. And it was sold out. I couldn't get tickets. And I messaged Vanessa and I said, is there any way you could get me some tickets for the show? She's like, yeah, sure. And she said, you should go and say hi to Stevie afterwards. And I was like, she won't remember me. We just went for dinner once a few months ago. And, you know, Elton John and Bono will be waiting to say hello to her in the dressing room. And she went, oh, shut up. Just go and say hi to her. I said, OK, I will. So we go there. We've got amazing seats. We're like 5 rows back. And 4 songs into the set, the band leave the stage and it's just her and Lindsay Buckingham. And she comes on the mic and she says, I'm going to play this song for the most rockin' chick who's in the audience tonight. This is for Katie Tunstall. And they played Landslide.
No.
I've never been so shocked. It was so unexpected. I didn't even know she knew I was there. And I was just, like, couldn't believe it. I was just going, this happens to a very small number of people in this universe. That Stevie Nicks dedicates Landslide to you at Wembley. Sure, it's exciting and it's nice and it's, you know, massages your ego, but I think whenever that happens, and it was happening too with Chrissy Hynde when I was touring with them, and, you know, I just love her. She's one of my heroes, and to have her sort of shout me out, and, you know, you have to earn that. These idols aren't going to give you a shout out if they think you're crap.
No.
It's because they recognise you and they see you and they want to extend a hand backwards. It was really funny when I was on that tour. It was the Simple Minds tour and Pretenders Won Out. And Chrissy, I found Chrissy totally intimidating and never actually managed to sort of sit down and have a lot of conversation with her because I was too scared.
Yeah,
but I found that too, every night, without fail, she shouted me out to the crowd, said how great she thought I was and would dedicate Brass in Pocket to me. And I would just be crying. And then one night towards the end of the tour, she goes, you got to check out Katie Tunstall. She really inspires me. And I was like, what are you talking about? You are Chrissy Hynde. I was like, no, I'm not having it. So I went and found her and I was like, what are you talking about that I inspire you? You inspire me. How do I inspire you? And she goes, I don't know. You're just so fucking friendly.
Sounds like Chrissy, yeah, absolutely.
I'm never going to feel like I'm in the same train car as these people.
I know what you mean.
You've worked hard to get really good at what you do. And that is your magic passport to have these communications with some of these people who've just really inspired you to become what you are. And yeah, you don't get that for free.
No, you don't. So Help Musicians is a charity that's given out grants to the tune of 17 million in the last year.
Unbelievable.
To songwriters and composers all over the country who have been on their ass, basically.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's enough empathy in the record industry?
I think there's none.
You're the only person who's been that honest.
I think there's none. And I have a good friend who's a music journalist, and she recently interviewed Sinead O'Connor. And she said, have you worked with anyone who's ever asked you what they can do to help you? And she said, why are you the first person who's ever asked me that?
Yikes.
Why is a music journalist the first person in my whole career who said, what can I do to make this easier for you? There's no HR. there's no number to call. There's no supervisor. And basically, touring and record industry, the biggest problem I think I have come up against in my job, trying to do my job well and trying to be a boss of an industry, of my own business, is because there's no rules in this game, in the industry side or in the touring side, as far as I can tell, there's not really a protocol of how you do things. It feels like everybody has their way of doing what they do. There's a real wall a lot of the time of listening to other ways of doing things that is some sort of compromise to make sure that everybody is healthy in that situation. And so as an artist, you feel like you're really being put through the ringer to fit a record company flowchart of how things work. I've always felt there's this weird one-size-fits-all mentality to record labels, which is just insane, because it's like you're dealing with completely different genres, personalities, abilities. And so I think the thing that really disturbs me the most is that there's this acceptance that artists die and artists commit suicide and artists take drugs and artists are depressed and they suffer for their art, you know? And I can relate to that, that suffering can lead to phenomenal work. It can lead to some of the best songs. They're medicinal in nature, but it's not a good situation when you've got a very high percentage of mentally unwell, suicidal, drug-abusing members of your community. That's not normal, you know, and there is an exceptionally high percentage of artists in that situation, and it's just kind of accepted.
That's what a lot of kids are attracted to when they want to join a band. They want that. That's part of the ticket.
Yeah, they want wildness, I think. They want to get out of the framework of society that it's offering them. You know, it's always going to happen, but I think too many times we've seen people go down that darker road and really no one around them do much about it.
Who do you lean on?
I lean on my friends. It's hard to lean on family because they just don't have any experience of it. And it's really, really hard to try and... Anyone you try and tell that your life is hard is like, oh, let me play my tiny violin for you, you know. And fair enough, it's a very privileged life. Yeah. I find it really hard in its relentlessness. It's like this massive lever that it's either on or off. And on is exhausting. Off is discombobulating and makes you nervous, and the actual action of pushing the lever is like twisting yourself in knots, you know. It's just like when you know you're going on tour, you're like, oh, I'm not gonna have a washing machine. Oh, I can't poo when I want.
We were talking about that today in rehearsals.
Oh, it's gonna smell bad. And then, you know, then the lever moving backwards, once you've got used to touring, is coming back to your house and just having eyes like dinner plates, just going, what is this room for? What do you do in this room? How do we eat? What? Who are you?
What a great life we have.
So it's very extreme. You've got to be pretty robust for it. And most artists aren't.
No. It's something that's taken many years to learn, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Katie, thank you so much
for
joining me.
My pleasure. It's always lovely talking to you. I love it. And I miss you.
Oh, I miss you too. I can't wait to see you soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of love.
God bless. Well, I hope you agree. That was a fantastic conversation. She fills me with joy and hope. The way that she deals with her life. She's so open and honest and such a fantastic performer. I've seen her on stage so many times, and it's just amazing to watch how she holds the audience in the palm of her hand. It's interesting that lots of people I've been speaking to on my podcasts have been concentrating their time on writing musical theatre. Shaftesbury Avenue is going to be full of fantastic shows in the future, I'm sure. Now, me and Katie, we have lots of things in common. But of course, the thing we don't have in common is I have not had dinner with Stevie Nicks. At least not yet. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. You can find out more about Help Musicians at www.helpmusicians.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and please leave us a review. We'd love to know what you think. See you on the next episode. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.